Speakers. I'm just a drunk.
Thank you.
And nothing too fancy about my story. I'm just a garden variety drunk. And I have a sobriety day too. And I want to thank Jessica for getting up here and talking. As far as I'm concerned, she could have continued on to the rest of the entire meeting, and I would have been content just listening to what she had to say. And but I have a sobriety day too. It's June 24th, 1985. And I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since that day. And I got to tell you something, that has very, very little to do with me. That has to do with everything. Kind of what this guy said, you know, and I really believe that we have to stick together as a group, and most of us will surely die. And it's a pretty good indicator that I can't do this thing on my own, and I don't much want to anymore either. And for a long, long time, I tried to do it on my own and with miserable results, meaning like I wasn't able to stay sober, and I was brought near death many, many times through my drinking. So I'm just happy to be sober, and I got to tell you, I owe Alcoholics Anonymous my ass. It saved my life, and today I know that, and I have a deep debt of gratitude for Alcoholics Anonymous and a lot of people that showed me the way and it kind of paved the path for me, and a lot of mentors and sponsors and people that, as far as I'm concerned, some of these people I may not have been able to stay sober without some of their guidance. And because that goes back to that same thing I was talking about, that we have to stick together. And I don't think I can do this on my own. I don't know if you're an alcoholic of my type. You may not be able to do it on your own either for long. And I know I sure can. So I just want to make sure that I pay a debt of gratitude to the people that's helped me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to share my story, and I'm going to talk a little bit about what I was like before I took my first drink, because I think it has some significance to my problem with alcoholism. I grew up in an alcoholic household. Six of us, four of us were alcoholics. My father died of alcoholism 1971, a day after my birthday. My mom was a drunk. My brother's a drunk. I'm a drunk. So out of six of us, four of us were alcoholics. So it's not very good odds, at least in my particular case. And I don't know if it's a genetic thing. I don't think it's really relevant to know, you know, was I born an alcoholic? I don't think it really matters. It's not going to serve any purpose today for me to know whether it's genetic or not. I just know I'm afflicted with alcoholism. And the household that I grew up in was kind of like, you know, you never really talked about how you felt. You never really showed any emotion whatsoever. You never asked for help. You just kind of went on along your life, just moving along as best you could through your own resources. You know, it's kind of was the self-reliance was driven home when I was a young kid. And in my particular family, you never walked up to my father and said, you know, I'm like really scared and frightened and I'm angry. I don't really know what to do with my emotions. Would you please sit down and kind of talk to me about that and kind of help me get through that? And that was never done in my household ever. And you just never did that with my father. And that's just the way it was. And so, you know, at a very young age, I was kind of a slow learner. You know, I wasn't very good in school. And I tried to disguise that with being defiant, rebellious, and I was always reluctant to authority. I didn't like authority at all. I was just a scared little frightened kid and with nowhere to go with it. And I grew up with a kind of a destructive attitude. I like to tear things up. And I think I used that as a way to disguise my fear and my anxiety. I had no outlet, nowhere to go with it. And I was one of those that was really could not handle his emotions at all. It was all about rage, anger, destruction, destroying whatever was around me, whether it was physically, mentally, emotionally, whatever it was. And that's kind of how I grew up, with a lot of fear, terrified of my father. There was just something about living in that household. I remember the fear, the impending doom, as they talk about it in the big book. And I couldn't quite put my finger on what it was about. But I was scared to death to go to sleep at night by myself, you know, when I was like 12, 13 years old. My brother and I shared a bed together, and I would beg him to stay up and let me go to sleep first. And I would just pull the covers up over my face and sweat all night long and being terrified of something that I really couldn't quite put my finger on what I was so frightened about. But that's the way I was. And so I had no outlet. I had no way to distribute those emotions in any normal fashion. So it came out in destructive behaviors. And that's kind of how I was, and I grew up like that. And, you know, at the age of 14 years old, right after my father had died, and my mom and dad divorced, and I seen a lot of things that took place there that weren't very pretty, and started developing a lot of ideas about the opposite sex and, you know, stuff with this and that and all the rest of that. And I kind of built this wall around me. It was like a little protective zone so where nobody could get to me and hurt me emotionally. And I was really good at pushing people away, you know, like being, like, not talking to them, just basically ignoring them, because I was scared to death that in some kind of way I was going to basically get hurt. So that's kind of how I protected myself. So I developed these little survival theories and beliefs and actions when I was a young kid. At the age of 14 years old, I had my first drink. And at that stage of the game, I had already developed, because I couldn't get good grades. And the reason why I wanted to get good grades really wasn't for me or to fit in school, but I just wanted my dad's approval. That was the bottom line. And somehow, in my mind, I figured if I could get these good grades, that he might love me. He might want to go out and play baseball. He might want to go fishing. He might want to sit down and just kind of like be a father-son kind of type of relationship, which is a normal kind of bonding between a father and son. And I never could achieve the goal. So what I developed at that stage of my life was like, I'm not good enough. I'm not smart enough. I'm not this enough. I'm not that enough. So I set in stone these old ideas about who I was way, way before I ever took my first drink. And I just never, ever measured up. And I spent the next 15 years of destructive drinking trying to prove to you, myself, and everybody else about those old ideas that I was right. And I would use you to prove that point because I needed to be right. And it would also help validate self-pity and judgment and self-hatred and all the destructive behavior that came out of that was the need to be right about these old ideas. Because, you know, if I can prove that I'm right, then that would, like, take me out of being a responsible, productive member of society. I could stand behind that and say, well, you know, I'm really stupid, so I'm not even going to try in school. I mean, it just would set the stage to be a victim for the rest of my life. And that's kind of how I lived. And at the age of 14 years old, I had my first drink, and I got to tell you something, that it all went away, like, in a matter of minutes. It just, like, went away. And all the stuff, the anxiety, the fear, all the old ideas, all the stuff that I carried around, which just seemed like a heavy load in my life, just kind of all just disappeared. And nothing really mattered to me anymore except getting more booze. And that was my main objective for the next 15 years, was getting more booze at any cost. And it didn't seem to matter. So what alcohol really did for me is it kind of fixed me mentally, emotionally, spiritually, I guess. It kind of changed the world that I lived in my own mind. I didn't live in a very good world up here. I just kind of gave you an idea of what the world was like, what I lived in, my world. And it just kind of made me feel complete to some degree. And it changed the world that I lived in. That's really what alcohol did for me. It just changed the world that I lived in. Not the world that you lived in, but my world. And at some stage of the game, alcohol turned out to be my master. It owned me. I mean, it absolutely owned me from the first drink to the last drink. It owned me. It was my master. And, you know, I started off mainly as a kind of a weekend warrior. I wasn't, like, so far gone, at least in my view or my perspective, that I needed to ask for help or go to AA or go to treatment or do any of that stuff. You know, I joined the Navy at 17 years old, and all I did in the Navy was drink. You know, I had no goals, no aspirations. I had nothing. My whole life was about drinking, partying, doing whatever the hell I wanted to do. That's what it was about for me. And nobody nothing ever got in my way of my drinking and the way I wanted to live my life. And 14 or 17 years old, I joined the Navy, and I stayed in the Navy for 6 months. I couldn't stay sober. I've been UA three times within 6 months, and the military kind of frowns on you got to show up on time. They don't like that when you don't show up. They send you to captain masses, and they don't have any sense of humor whatsoever about, you know, about me or anything. They just don't really care about that, and they booted me out. You know, I made it about 6 months in the Navy, and they kicked my butt right out because they weren't going to put up with that crap. You know, I wasn't capable of being responsible, showing up for work on time. And they said, you know, we had enough for you. It's time to go. And so they kicked me out at 18 years old. So I was only in for 7 months. I got out and right away found her for the first time, the first her. And I did that right out of the Navy. I got a job at this sanitarium, like as a maintenance guy. I didn't have any education. But I was always, I'll tell you what, some of the good attributes about myself was that I was always a hard worker. I always worked hard. I showed up. I gave you pretty much everything I had. I was always a hard worker, very ambitious. So I did have some good qualities about myself, but I would not recognize them. I would allow everything else to override that. So I got a job at this place as a maintenance guy and kind of a janitor, kind of a cleanup guy, and I showed up every day, and I seen her, my first wife. I've been married three times, and she was my first. And 18, 19 years old, I was so frightened, and I was so haunted by these ideas that I'm not good enough, you know, and I'm not going to measure up, and I'm not smart enough. So I always had to have about a six-pack of beer to go talk to her and get up enough courage and go present this stage character that I had it all together, which I really didn't, but I needed to let her know that I did. And you know how hard it is to keep that thing going? You know, like the big book talks about that we lead a double life. And I do lead a double life. I mean, I've even done this in sobriety. To the outer world, this is what I want you to see. But underneath it all, I'm basically a scared little frightened kid that really kind of like driven by self-centeredness that demands to get his own way almost all the time in every area of my life. And that's kind of what it was about. And it took about six beers for me to show up to her and start lying about who I thought I was. And she brought into it. She was like 17. She was a kid. You know, and I always had, there was some kind of unique quality I had about myself. I could always see the vulnerability in this particular woman because she was, like, insecure. She was scared. She had no, at least according to my perception, she had nothing really going for her, and I kind of, like, moved right in on that. The very vulnerable, insecure women that really didn't have much going for her, and I'd show up like the shining knight in armor, like I was something special. And she was attracted to that, and so we ended up getting married, and I stayed married to that woman for 9 years, and I put her through absolute, utter hell for 9 years. 9 years of destructive drinking. I'm talking about in the beginning, I was like a weekend warrior. My deal was that I'm going to go out for just a couple of beers and get home at a decent hour, and I really meant it. I mean, I sincerely really meant that I was going to be home at a certain time. But what I didn't know was that I already had alcoholism. It was in full swing. So I would go out on weekends and drink and stay out most of the night and come cruising in at daybreak, turning off the headlights and kind of cruising in with the motor off. And I would sneak upstairs and try to get in bed without her knowing that I'd been out all night. And of course, you have to be able to lie about that. Where were you? What's going on? And I lied about everything. I lied about my drinking, where I'd been, who I was with. You know, you got to be a great liar to disguise this lifestyle that I had to live because of my alcoholism. It's like all one big package deal to be a great liar. And I was a great manipulator and a great liar when I was out there drinking. I could make you believe pretty much anything I wanted to, as long as I thought there was something in it for me. And that's kind of what it was. And what I wanted from her was I wanted her to trust me and to believe that I would do what I say I was going to do. So that didn't work out. So we would talk about stretching the time out. You know, you can't seem to make it home at midnight, so let's shoot for 2 o'clock in the morning. Do you think you can do that? Well, we had a little debate or discussion And I said, yeah, I think I can make the 2 o'clock curfew. And of course, I couldn't make the 2 o'clock curfew ever. And one more time, I'd come squeezing in the driveway with the motor off and the lights off, and I would skip upstairs trying to be as quiet as the... And she knew I'd have been out drunk all night one more time. And the selfishness of the lifestyle that I live and the inconsideration, things that I never, ever thought about, like... He's been out all night. He hasn't called. Is he dead? Is he in the hospital? What's going on with him? I mean, she lived with that terror weekend after weekend, sooner or later, night after night after night. And one time, I'll just share this one story with you. This is one of many stories. I went out one night, and we were out looking for trouble. We were drunk, and we found it. And we got into a fight with 3 guys, and right out in the middle of Broadway and 8th Street in Chula Vista. And one guy had a knife, and I didn't see it. And I got out in the middle of the street, and I was fighting with this guy. He stabbed me 3 times, three times in the back, and right up in here hit an artery. And I almost died that night. And blood was gushing out. I mean, it was... Luckily, there was an ambulance across the street taking a break, and they seen what had happened. They came over, and he took me to the hospital, and I almost bled to death that night. You would think anybody normal would just stop that drinking, because the drinking is what led me up to being where I was. But it wasn't really about the drinking. It was about being at the wrong place at the wrong time, in my mind. And, you know, it was like I was not going to take any accountability for my actions or what we did. It was all about what they did. We were out looking for trouble, and we found it. So that's just one of the many incidences that I put her through. And to this very day, I don't think I will ever realize to the depth of the misery and the terror and frustration that I put that woman through for 9 years. I mean, I'm so self-centered today, I don't think I can really see it for what it really is. But I know I put her through a lot. So at about 9 years into that marriage, she got tired of me, and it was time to hit the road. And how that happened was she kind of got hooked up with my best friend, and she got attracted to him. Anyway, she ended up with this guy, and they got together, and they're still together to this very day. And that's the best thing that she ever did, was to get away from me. She's got a life today. She doesn't live in terror. I mean, this guy treats her with respect, treats her like she's a woman. He's everything that I wasn't capable of being because of my alcoholism. I mean, I'm the kind of selfish and self-centered person. It's all about me all the time. And it doesn't really matter what your needs are and what your wants are. It's all about what can you do for me to make me feel good, like upon demand, right here and right now. And it was never about, you know, any compassion or any affection or any of that, or loving or any of that kind of stuff with her at all. I mean, she was just there. And so she got smart. It took her 9 years to get there. She's kind of a slow learner too, but she finally got there. And they're still married to this very day, and they got kids. And thank God for the steps, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, because when I got sober, the big thing that was haunting me was their big resentment towards her and him and what they done to me. And I hadn't done an inventory yet, so I was nowhere nearly ready to be accountable for my actions and my faults and where I was wrong in that relationship until I did that 4th step. And so she was married, and everything's going good there, and it's like in the early 80s. My alcoholism now is getting to the point to where I'm drinking almost every day. And I'm waking up, you know, shaking, the dry heaves, just basically sick from drinking, and I can't seem to stop. I remember I had a job at the shipyard, and to give you an example on how my alcoholism works, my goal was I always wanted to be somebody too. I wanted to be like hooked up with the big guys and to be part of the group, because I had no self-esteem. And I figured if I could get next to these guys, maybe they would somehow improve my self-image of myself. And that was an old idea, too, that is not very effective. So my goal was when I get my check on Friday night, I'm going to go hook up with these guys at Pete's Bar on Main Street. And, in fact, it's still there. Pete's Bar on Main Street in San Diego, still there. And every time I drive by there, I get the memories of that night. I went in there with the idea of I'm going in to have a couple of beers, cash my check with the real workers, the shipyard guys, and kind of just have a couple, no more than 2 or 3, and go home and be a regular kind of guy And I showed up there 16 beers later. I was kind of in a blackout, lost my car on the railroad tracks, didn't know how the hell I got there or even why I was there, driving all over town, having my brother-in-law chase me, and that's kind of how alcoholism works for me. It's kind of like my intention is to go out and have just a couple of beers, and I really think that I can do that. But alcoholism, because I'm physically allergic to alcohol, won't allow me to do what my mind thinks it can. I don't know if you can relate to that. But that's kind of how it was. That was like a pretty good example of how I drank. And several years later, I'm starting to have some serious problems with my drinking. I can't seem to hold down a job. I can't maintain any kind of functional relationship with anybody at all. I never really could because of these old ideas and this fear and being so suspicious of people all the time. I was kind of like a loner to kind of distance myself from people because I was frightened primarily. And I was driven and ruled by these old beliefs and these old ideas. And it's kind of like, again, alcohol kind of made it all go away. So at the age of, in my early 20s, I had made my first attempt at suicide. And I got to the point in my life that the misery and the depression and like there's no chance that I would ever, ever have a happy life or have anything other than what I have at certain times became very apparent. And I got desperate enough to try to take my own life. And I did this like two or three different times and it didn't work. And one of the times I tried this, I came out of this coma one time and there was a psychiatrist standing next to me and we were going through this divorce with my first wife. And this guy says to me, he says, what would it take to make you happy? That was his basic question, his only question. And I told him, I just want my wife back. And the guy looked straight at me, and he pulled my covers right there on the spot, and he looked right at me and says, that won't make you happy. And he turned around and walked off. He seen right through me in a matter of seconds. Like I had been opened up my eyes, not even 5 minutes. And he was right. There's no way that she was going to fulfill me enough to where I didn't need to drink or to make all these old ideas go away or any of this kind of stuff. And so I continued to drink, and alcoholism got so bad that in the early 80s, I would have brief moments of how bad things really was with my drinking. And I would show up to meetings, like in 82, 83, and, you know, basically just coming out of the county jail or coming out of CMH, and my ass was on fire, and I knew I needed help, and I was frightened. And I would show up to AA because I was frightened, and I knew I was in deep trouble with my drinking. And I would show up, and I would listen to people talk about not drinking, and I would say, yeah, I'm going to get sober. Like, I was somewhat of a pretender at the time. I really wasn't interested in doing the steps or doing the program or doing any of that stuff. What I was really interested in doing is getting the heat off and getting the police off my ass and the judges and to kind of like just do the best I can. But I wasn't really interested in getting sober, so I didn't stay sober. I was kind of like partially alcoholic at the time. I wasn't really fully 100% hopeless case because I had two or three more years of destructive drinking before I got there. And for the next two or three years, I had destructive drinking. And what happened with me, June 24th of 85, two or three more years of destructive drinking, a couple more suicide attempts, more unmanageability of my life, and I got to the point where I couldn't imagine life with or without alcohol. And I got locked up one more time in the San Diego County Jail for these 502 tickets. I had five 502s. I ended up in the county jail, and I knew that I was dying from drinking, and I knew I was hopeless, and I couldn't stop. I simply could not stop drinking. And what I did was only out of a sense of desperation. It surely has nothing to do with any virtuous ideas at all. I was just confronted with the fact that if I don't stop drinking, I'm going to die drunk. That's what happened with me. And June 24th of 1985, I'd reached the absolute bottom with my drinking, and I knew alcohol was my master, and I just said, dear God, help. And that's kind of how I took the first step. I didn't understand what alcoholism was. I didn't understand the mental obsession, the physical allergy, the spiritual. I didn't know any of that stuff. I just knew that I was dying from drinking and couldn't stop. I went to an institution in September of that year. And, you know, being defiant, rebellious, reluctant, and, you know, I don't want to ask God for help, obviously, because there's no way that I'm going to surrender my life to a power greater than myself or anybody else. I got in this institution, and I heard some of these people coming around talking about drinking and alcoholism and what they thought and how they felt and how they lived their lives. And I knew that I was like them, and I could identify with these people. And they were sober, and they were happy. They seemed to be reasonably happy in their own skin. And I wanted that. I wanted to be sober more than anything else in this world, and I still do. So these guys kept talking about some basic things like steps and going to meetings and coming to believe in a power greater than themselves and inventory and prayer and meditation and working with others. And these guys, that was the common thread that they had running through their lives. And they were sober and they were reasonably happy even through adversity. And so they had something that I couldn't achieve on my own, which was sobriety. And I'm not talking about really emotional sobriety because I don't know. That comes and goes for me. I mean, I gave up on the idea a long time ago that my sobriety is contingent on my emotional stability on any given day, because it's not. I'm talking about physical sobriety, and all that other stuff will come over, and it goes, too. It comes and goes. That's been my experience. And so these guys were really big on not drinking, and so I got hooked up with some of these guys, and I basically asked them to show me what they did. And they told me, you know, what we recommend to you first is read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when you get done with that, get next to me or call me or let me know when you're through and we'll get together. And I'll show you what I did out of the big book of Alcoholics. So I did it. Only because I had no other place to go and I was dying from drinking. I had no choice, so I did it. And what I did was I made the mistake of reading the doctor's opinion, and that kind of changed my life forever. I realized after reading that chapter the grave nature of my condition, that I have a physical allergy coupled with a mental obsession, and that I was absolutely 100% powerless over alcohol today, right now. And that has not changed since I've been sober. And today, right now, my life is unmanageable as well. Not as bad as it was, but it still is to a degree. And what feeds that and supports that or my old ideas and my defects of character and my behavior and how I live my life and how I think you think of me and on and all my fear and all that kind of stuff. And but I'm powerless over alcohol today. And what that means to me is that means that I better come to believe in a power greater than myself, because on my own, there's no possible way I can keep me sober. There's no way. I've lost the power of choice in drink. I lost it a long time ago. And nowhere in my big book does it tell me, anywhere in it that I have ever seen, that I get the power of choice back. Anywhere. What it does say is that I have a daily reprieve, and it's contingent on a fit spiritual condition. That's what it tells me. And so what happened with me is I got desperate enough to do the steps, and I developed some degree of willingness to do the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as a result of doing the steps, you know, this one guy was the guy that actually showed me how to do the 4-step out of the big book. I finally got enough courage to go up and ask him, how do you do this 4-step the way it's written in this big book? And he showed me. And I did my real 4th and 5th step with this guy early on in my earlier sobriety days. And since that time, I've had a lot of guys that's worked with me. When I had a guy work with me for 15 years, and he knows who he is, and he was probably the biggest instrumental person in my entire sobriety, and he showed me a lot of things, and he taught me a lot of things, and I'll always be forever grateful to that guy, because he doesn't like to say it, but in my mind, and I'll say it because I can, he was part of saving my life. Because I hooked up with him when she left me in sobriety, and that was a pretty painful at about 6 years sober. And I learned how to do inventory, and I learned how to take care of myself and go to meetings. And I got taught that, you know, being committed to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that there's no way that him or anybody else is going to keep me sober. that I need to rely on a power greater than myself. And so I learned that from this particular individual, and that's what I implement with guys that I work with today, is how to help others. And my sobriety has been, it's a gift. It's just a flat-ass gift. My sobriety, even the pain and the suffering and some of the things, some of it self-inflicted, some of it not. I was a single parent for 10 years in sobriety. I got to raise a boy that right now is off in Afghanistan, and that troubles me almost every day that on my waking hours. And I've learned how to take care of myself with that. I write fear inventories. I make these fear lists, and I write out why I have the fear, and I ask God to remove my fear. And I talk to people about it, and I just try to grasp on and latch on to what little faith I have to realize that He's in God's hands. He's not my hands. He's not like I'm not. It really shows me how powerless I am over life and people, places, and things. I have no power over any of this stuff. And I have to surrender Him to a power greater than myself. And I don't like that, because that means that I'm not in charge. And I really prefer to be in charge and have my hand in it somehow, some way. And I can't do that. And, you know, we lost our niece, this May it'll be a year, to a tragic accident. And, you know, our family's had a lot of heartache over the last year or so. And, you know, I haven't... The beauty about the whole thing, there's two things. Number one, I haven't wanted to take a drink over any of it, nor have I even thought about it. And the other thing is there's something inside me that knows, no matter how bad things seem to appear, no matter what they are, if I keep doing Alcoholics Anonymous, coming to meetings, doing prayer and meditation, doing inventory, and helping others, which is kind of a big deal, God will do for me what I can't do for myself, which is to keep me sober. And there's something inside me that knows, no matter what's going on in my life, everything is going to be okay. And I don't know what that is. I think that maybe it's that inner resource that's way deep down inside all of us, according to what that big book says. There is some suspected inner resource that's way deep down inside of me. And my goal is like, what can I do to get close to that? I mean, that's kind of like my spiritual objective, is what can I do to get close as I possibly can to this fundamental idea of God that the big book says is way deep down inside of me. And the whole purpose of the steps, as far as I'm concerned, is to remove as much of that stuff that's within me that's blocking me from that. And inventory and going to meetings and helping others and making amends and all, and prayer and meditation is kind of like the path or the road that I go down to remove all that stuff that's blocking me from God, because it's really all about God. I mean, that's what's going to keep me sober, is God. I mean, that's where I need to find my strength. I find it here with people as well, because I think God works through people, but ultimately when it comes down to it, it comes down to between me and God. You know, when I'm by myself to talk to, I better have something to rely on. And so it's, you know, I have a really, really, it's all because of Alcoholics Anonymous and a power greater than myself. Never had it so good. Even with my present pressing problems, so I think they're problems, but perhaps they're not. You know, even my defects of character that I have today, they might be more of an ability in some cases. And I'll tell you why I think that is, because without these defects of character that I have, what do I have to share with another person when I'm doing a fifth step? What do I have, these old ideas that I have about myself, if I didn't have these, I wouldn't be able to share these with someone else and say, yeah, I felt like that too. I thought like that. And that's how I acted as well. And this is the reason why. What do you think of that? So in one sense, maybe these defects of character seem to be bad, but in another sense, maybe they turn out to be an asset, only in this arena, but nowhere else except here. And I really see him like that. I mean, this guy that I was talking about tried to impress upon me many, many years, and over and over and over. And I do these inventories with this guy, and we would start talking about steps 6 and 7. And I would say, you know, I don't understand why this pride and this selfishness is still here to this degree. And he made it really clear to me. He told me one time, and more than once, he says, you better find a way to accept yourself as you are. And I finally have gotten there, and I realized that my defects of character aren't my business to remove. They're not. I mean, I can't fix me. I can't remove them on my own. But what I can do is place myself in a position of readiness for them to be removed, and the rest is God's job. I can't make them go away. And I finally got that, and it took me a long, long time to get that, to let go of that idea, to think that perhaps maybe I can change these things on my own, and I can't. And so I've obviously got a lot to learn. Alcoholics Anonymous is definitely the best thing that's ever happened to me in my life. And some days I feel like I'm hopelessly lost, you know, even after being sober for a few years. And I don't know that that's always a bad thing. I mean, I think it keeps my mind open up to spiritual ideas and spiritual beliefs because, you know, on my own, you know, I'm not going to really be very good at anything. But with the power greater than myself and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and you people, you know, I can be sober and reasonably happy. So I'm pretty much done. Thanks.